Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Education Report and the Making of a Nation, coming up after As It Is.
Hello, and welcome to As It Is from VOA Learning English. I'm Christopher Cruz in Washington. Today on the program, we report on what American voters say are the most important issues facing the country. Two of the most common answers were the Ebola virus and the threat from Islamic State militants in Iraq and Syria. And as we will hear, some congressional candidates are listening to those fears.
The current military action that's taking place against the Islamic State is a factor when you remind Americans of it that they say, that could be important.
Then we will hear from a 16-year-old boy who was kidnapped by the Islamic State. He says the group beat him, threatened to execute him, and said he must kill his parents.
We were scared, Azad said. They had long beards. They told us, "We will slaughter you, you infidels."
The worries of American voters as we approach midterm elections, and the kidnapping and abuse of a teenaged boy by Islamic State militants. Those are our subjects today on As It Is from VOA. Opinion surveys show feelings of unease among likely American voters as they prepare for congressional, state, and local elections early next month. The Gallup organization recently asked a group of Americans what they thought are the most important issues facing the country. The top 10 answers included the Ebola virus and the threat from Islamic State militants in Iraq and Syria. The Republican Party is often critical of President Barack Obama. Some Republican candidates are questioning how safe Americans are under Mr. Obama, a Democrat. Yet some Democrats are blaming Republicans for cutting government spending on public health as Ebola worries surface. Katie Weaver now with more on the story.
Frightening news from overseas has come home for many Americans. An example was confirmation of the first cases of Ebola in the United States.
Good morning. A second healthcare worker at Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital has preliminarily tested positive for Ebola.
There were also the recent executions of two American journalists and a British aid worker. Islamic State militants claimed responsibility for the killings.
Is James Wright Foley an American citizen of your country?
The apparent threat from Islamic State fighters has become a campaign issue in the United States. So says Frank Newport, editor-in-chief of the Gallup poll.
The current military action that's taking place against the Islamic State is a factor when you remind Americans of it that they say, that could be important. And some candidates at the Senate level are trying to take advantage of it, as, of course, politicians will do.
Republican supporters are using television advertisements to tie current Democrats in the United States Senate to President Obama. The ads accuse the Senate Democrats of being weak on national security.
While radical Islamists threaten to attack America and millions cross our border undetected, President Obama and Senator Landrieu have done nothing.
Several ads from conservative groups against Democrats combine the separate issues of Islamic State terrorists and illegal immigration.
Evil forces around the world want to harm Americans every day. Their entry into our country through Arizona's backyard. Yet Ann Kirkpatrick consistently votes with her party against protecting Arizona.
For their part, some Democratic supporters are attacking Republicans on the internet. This ad on the YouTube website criticizes Republican candidates for cutting government spending.
Washington actually can cut spending.
The CDC says its discretionary funding has been cut by $585 million since 2010.
Cut. Less government. Cut.
VOA spoke with two Americans who were visiting Washington, D.C. Mary Hutter is from Virginia, while Frank Wyman lives in South Carolina. When asked if they were worried about Ebola, each had mixed feelings.
I'm not afraid that it's going to become a huge thing. I mean, the disease is horrible, but I am not afraid about our own medical system.
I'm getting worried. I'm not scared yet. I think we'll get it all figured out.
Some campaign ads may seem frightening, but most Americans still say their top issues in this election are the economy, unemployment, and dissatisfaction with the government. I'm Katie Weaver.
You are listening to As It Is from VOA Learning English. Last June, Islamic State militants kidnapped more than 150 students from the city of Kobani in northern Syria. Many of those kidnapped were ethnic Kurds. The militants released most of the students several months later. But about 20 students remain in captivity. One of those freed is a 16-year-old boy named Azad. He now lives in Turkey. Bob Doty is here now with his story.
Azad said the militants seized him and the other students as they were returning home. He said the students had just finished taking their secondary school exams in the Syrian city of Aleppo. We were scared, Azad said. They had long beards. They told us, "We will slaughter you, you infidels." Islamic State militants have executed thousands of people. The group has accused its victims of being infidels. In other words, for not following what the militants say is the true religion. Azad said, for 3 months, the group beat the teenagers and threatened to execute them. They hit us and gave us religion lessons. They were taking medicine. Their eyes became red after that. They put bombs on themselves and said, "We will go to heaven." We cried and said, "We want to go to our parents." They hit us and said, "Why are you crying for your parents? If you become Muslims and return to Kobani, you must kill your parents, because they are infidels," remembered Azad. Azad passed his exams in Aleppo. He wants to be an engineer. He said he hopes to continue his education in Kobani someday. I'm Bob Doty.
That's our program for today. I'm Christopher Cruz. I invite you to join us again tomorrow at this same time for another edition of As It Is, here on the Voice of America.
The Education Report is next, followed by The Making of a Nation. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
This is the VOA Learning English Education Report. Writing an essay or paper for school can feel like, and often is, a big challenge. But an expert from Duke University in North Carolina has some ideas to make the process easier and produce better results. Jennifer Ahern Dodson is an assistant writing professor. She also helps organize writing groups for both students and teachers. She believes getting advice and suggestions from others can help. Ms. Ahern Dodson says that students usually share their writing only when it is completed and ready to give to the teacher. Instead, she suggests that you prepare an early draft version. Then, ask yourself, who can give you helpful feedback or reaction on what you have written?
Who can I share it with who can give me feedback? What I like to describe that as is finding the right reader at the right time.
Or, Ms. Ahern Dodson says you may want more than one reader to comment. You may want a writing group.
A lot of my work with students and faculty is helping them form communities of writers and share writing on a regular basis.
She says starting a group takes a little bit of cultivating. One requirement is that everyone taking part must offer their own work for comment.
Like any community, you don't build trust immediately. Part of it is everyone has to be willing to share their own writing, and you have to establish ground rules, rules of the road, right?
Ms. Ahern Dodson says these rules should include what kind of feedback is needed.
Usually folks don't want people to be mean, but you want your readers to be specific and give useful feedback.
She says that means much more than saying, good job, or great, without real thought. She says sharing writing can reduce the stress that many students feel when they write a paper just before a deadline, the time limit. This is the idea of a student who goes into a room alone and 12 hours later comes out with a good paper. She says some people call this binge writing.
Yes, some people can do that successfully, but usually it's not a positive experience that you want to do again and again and again.
She has other ideas for what she called a sane and enjoyable writing life. Ms. Ahern Dodson says some people form writing groups where they live. Others establish groups with other students from their classes.
Some just meet at a coffee shop and bring whatever writing that they're working on at the time. You know, finding a community of writers that helps to not only get your writing going, but keep your writing going.
She says that is very valuable for writing well. And that's the VOA Learning English Education Report for today. I'm Jerry Watson.
Thank you. Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In any war, the enemy's capital city is an important target. To capture the enemy's capital usually means victory. In the American Civil War, the North hoped for a quick victory by capturing the southern capital at Richmond, Virginia. Northern forces were strong enough. There were about 150,000 Union soldiers in and around Washington. General George McClellan led this Army of the Potomac. It was the biggest, best trained, and best equipped of the Union armies. This week in our series, Larry West and Tony Riggs report on McClellan's move against Richmond.
For the first year of the Civil War, the Army of the Potomac did not fight. General McClellan kept making excuses for his failure to act. He had a plan, he said, and he would not move until he was sure his men were ready. McClellan's plan was to put his army on boats in the Potomac River. They would sail down the river to where it emptied into the Chesapeake Bay. Then he would land the boats on the coast of Virginia, east of Richmond. President Abraham Lincoln wanted to capture the Confederate capital, but he did not like the idea of moving all of McClellan's men. That would leave the city of Washington without protection. McClellan tried to calm Lincoln's fears. He said that as soon as he marched toward Richmond, any Confederate soldiers near Washington would withdraw. They would be needed to defend their own capital.
The Army of the Potomac began to move on March 17th, 1862. Within 2 weeks, more than 50,000 had reached Fort Monroe, southeast of Richmond. They were equipped with 100 big guns and tons of supplies. Day by day, the Union force at Fort Monroe grew larger. McClellan had planned to move quickly to Yorktown, then push on to Richmond. He would move along the finger of land between the York River and the James River. He soon learned, however, that he could not move as quickly as planned. Heavy spring rains had turned the dirt roads into rivers of mud. McClellan's men could push through, but there was no way they could bring their big guns. McClellan decided to wait. He did not want to attack Yorktown without artillery.
President Lincoln was not pleased. He sent a message to McClellan. "You must strike a blow," Lincoln said. "You must act." But still, McClellan delayed. By the time his artillery had arrived and was in place, Confederate troops had withdrawn. They moved to the woods outside Williamsburg. McClellan chased them. For the first time, his army went into battle. The fighting was strange. The woods were so thick that the two sides could not often see each other. Soldiers fired at the flash of gunpowder, at noises, anything that moved. Their aim was good enough. About 4,000 soldiers were killed.
In his reports to Washington, McClellan claimed great victories at Yorktown and Williamsburg. Yet, he was worried. He believed the Confederate force around Richmond was much larger than his. He demanded more men. The Confederate force was, in fact, much smaller than the Union force. But it was deployed in a way to make it seem much larger. The trick fooled McClellan. By the middle of May, 1862, his army was only 15 kilometers from Richmond. Still, he did not attack. He continued to wait for more men and equipment. Confederate President Jefferson Davis was worried. He knew the Confederate Army was smaller than the Union Army. Davis's military advisor, General Robert E. Lee, offered a plan. Lee proposed that General Stonewall Jackson lead his army up Virginia's Shenandoah Valley. The North would see the move as a threat to Washington. Union troops would be kept near Washington instead of being sent to Richmond. President Davis agreed. Orders were sent to Jackson.
Stonewall Jackson was one of the South's best generals. He was a forceful leader, and he could make his men march until they dropped. He got the name Stonewall at the Battle of Bull Run in the summer of 1861. Southern soldiers were withdrawing. A Confederate officer tried to stop them. He urged them to follow Jackson's example, to stand and fight. He shouted, "There stands Jackson like a stone wall." General Jackson faced three large Union forces in and around the Shenandoah Valley. Yet he struck hard and fast, and soon had control of the valley's main towns. His campaign is still studied at military schools around the world. It is considered an excellent example of how to move troops quickly to where they are most needed.
Jackson's raids produced the exact effect Robert E. Lee had wanted. Everyone in Washington feared an immediate attack on the city. Soldiers were hurried to the capital from Baltimore and other nearby cities. And President Lincoln sent thousands of troops to chase Jackson in the Shenandoah Valley instead of helping McClellan at Richmond. The Union Army outside Richmond was deployed on either side of the Chickahominy River. The Chickahominy was not a big river. It could be crossed easily at several places. While McClellan waited to attack the Confederate capital, heavy rains began to fall. The little river began to rise. The commander of Confederate forces in Richmond saw this as a chance to smash a large part of McClellan's army.
The flooding river would soon cut the Union force completely in two. When that happened, the Confederates would attack. They expected to destroy at least half of McClellan's army. The plan seemed good. And after the first few hours of battle, the Confederates were close to victory. But one bridge remained over the Chickahominy River. Union soldiers were able to cross it. The Confederates were forced to withdraw to their earlier positions. No ground was gained, and more than 11,000 men were killed or wounded. Among the wounded was the commander of all Confederate forces, General Joe Johnston. General Robert E. Lee would take his place.
Lee wasted no time. He wanted to push the Union Army far away from Richmond. First, however, he wanted more information about his enemy. He sent a young officer, Jeb Stuart, to get it. Stuart set off with more than 1,000 men on horseback. Theirs was a wild ride around the edge of the Union Army. When they reported back 3 days later, General Lee knew exactly where he would attack. It would be the first in a series of battles known as the 7 Days Campaign.
Lee took a big chance. He moved most of his men into position to attack what he now knew was the weak right side of the Union line. He left only a few thousand men to defend Richmond. He hoped the Union commander, McClellan, would be fooled by this plan. For if McClellan discovered how few men were left behind, he could smash through easily and capture the city. With the help of Stonewall Jackson's army, Lee's plan worked. McClellan was fooled, and after a day of fierce fighting, he was forced to withdraw from the area.
Lee chased McClellan for a while. They clashed at such places as Mechanicsville, White Oak Swamp, and finally Malvern Hill. The South won the 7 Days campaign. The threat to Richmond was ended. The Confederacy was saved. But victory came at a terrible price. 20,000 Confederate soldiers were killed or wounded. As both the North and South were learning quickly, the Civil War was becoming more costly than anyone had imagined.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Larry West and Tony Riggs. Our series can be found online with transcripts, podcasts, and historical images at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow our weekly programs on Twitter at VOA Learning English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.